Okay, it is May 12th, 2026, and we are welcoming back Monica R, who was off. We gave her vacation. She used her vacation time. But thank you for recording these, Monica. For anybody who listens to these, it's Monica you have to thank. Okay, so we're going to do about 20 minutes of meditation, which I will guide to the best of my ability for at least a certain period of that 20 minutes. And I think, I'm gonna ring a bell to start things. I don't usually do that, but it's good to have a starter moment. Settling into your posture, coming into stillness. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Turning the attention inward. Feeling the body in a general sense, just the feeling of sitting here. Acknowledging to yourself as well how you're feeling right now. That idea of feeling can have different meanings. It could be how you're feeling physically, emotionally, whether you're tired or alert. If anything stands out in any of those areas, how are you feeling? And connecting with the breath. Can you feel your breath and be aware of feeling as well? Or not paying attention to the breath to try to exclude all other experiences. The breath is a kind of central focus. But awareness also contains a broader experience of the body. Feeling, mental states. The attention often gets hijacked by thinking. So we have to pay particular attention to this, the movements of mind, and gently come back when we realize the mind is wandering. Well, we're not trying to suppress or exclude thought. We also don't want to just drift off into daydreaming. Our practice requires a certain patience. Typically, at the beginning of a sitting, the mind is more busy, the body might be more restless. And there can be a sense that this isn't working, I have to do something else to make it work, to get some quiet, some calm. But really, if we just trust in the process, the Buddha says training the mind, just repeatedly coming back, reconnecting with the breath each moment when it's lost. Letting the breath act as a calming device. This is very natural. As we exhale, breath can help to calm the nervous system. Again, not suppressing, but think of it as releasing tension. And if releasing doesn't seem to be happening, then just feeling, allowing, non-resistance. Just as the mind wanders, so too does the body. Notice when the posture slumps or tilts. And very gently, with the breath, bringing it back to center, to balance. All right. Hope everyone is well. Was just glancing at the chat there. Okay. Well, what is on the Dharma plate today? On the recovery plate. Just FYI, the Buddhist Recovery Network is planning a conference in Oakland, October 2nd to the 4th, if you are able to attend. It should be a really great event. Our conferences are really joyful and really very social affairs, a lot of connection happening. And we have various interesting presenters and workshops and things. So if you are able to be in Oakland, October 2nd to 4th, should think about joining. I don't think it's on our website yet. We're still finishing up the details of the planning. I myself will be teaching in Berkeley tonight, at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, 2304 McKinley Avenue in Berkeley, near the Berkeley High School. And other than that, next week, I think starting on Thursday, I teach at Big Bear Retreat Center with Vimla Sara for a residential retreat. Anybody who's interested in that, Big Bear, pretty beautiful spot up in the mountains outside LA. So I was, I think I mentioned that I've been kind of going through Ajahn Pasano's book, Abundant and Exalted Immeasurable, which is taken from a loving kindness retreat he taught quite a few years ago. And it, I've been through it before, and in fact, the odd thing about reading it is that much of what he addresses, even the suttas that he addresses, are the same things I addressed in my book, Living Kindness. And I keep thinking, like, did I read this before that? Did I steal all that? And I'm pretty sure I didn't, even though this was published before my book, but I don't think I saw it. And he actually read my manuscript when I was working on it. And I don't remember him saying, oh, you know what? I already wrote this book. Why are you writing it? Anyway, as with any book that's taken from a retreat, so it's kind of transcribed, it has more of the sound of someone speaking as opposed to writing. But this is the piece that I was reading this morning. And it's a section of the book where he's going through the Metta Sutta line by line and kind of commenting on it. The Metta Sutta is the Buddha's words on loving kindness. He says, the nature of the human mind is such that we have a whole bank of experiences, both internally within ourselves and externally from society that impinges on us. All of that can pop up in the mind as thoughts, because that is what a mind is for, to provide thoughts. But as meditators, we have to use discernment. What are we going to invest in? What are we going to put our energy into? So I thought that was a really, it captured several things that are really important. I love this line. That is what a mind is for. To provide thoughts. And then the following line, but as meditators, we have to use discernment. What are we going to invest in? And so, in other words, not to assume that you don't understand this, but just to draw it out more explicitly, thoughts appear in the mind, but it's up to us how we're going to respond to them, what we're going to do with them. If we're not aware of them, we will, in the ordinary human way, just act on them, speak on them, be think more about them, and believe them, right? And just like, oh, this information coming through my mind. And what Ajahn Pasano is reminding us is that it's just your mind. Your mind is just doing what it does. I like this idea. What a mind is for is to provide thoughts. So it's like, here are some options that you could think about or that you could believe, or here are some ideas that are, available to you now. It's up to you what you decide to do with them. I think it's a great description of how we're, as practitioners, as meditation practitioners, we, should, if you will, work with our thoughts. And again, as I say again, because it's such a persistent topic, it's also saying that when I'm meditating, I'm not trying to stop my thoughts, but realize that they're just being provided to me as options to reflect on or to let go of. It says, and here he uses the word kama, which is the Pali for karma. Kama is Kamma, so there's no R in it, but same word. He says, that is where kama is created, whether it be the mental kama of investing in thoughts of ill will, aversion, and greed, or the mental kama of investing in renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. We are making that choice. That's the kama that we're creating. So again, just really reiterating this idea that we are making the choice as to what thoughts we're going to follow. And so he then says, sometimes people think perhaps if they're upset or devastated, I had this terrible thought of aversion. Well, did you act on it? No. Well, don't make a problem out of it. Thoughts pop up in the same way that there are all kinds of things happening in the world around us. What do we pay attention to? Where do we allow our attention to rest and gather momentum? Abiding in loving kindness is a conscious choice that we make, both for ourselves and on account of how it affects others. So, abiding in loving kindness is a conscious choice we can make. What do we pay attention to? Where do we allow our attention to rest and gather momentum? I mean, it just speaks to so directly to the this human condition and that we deal with day in, day out, moment by moment, what's showing up in our mind. And again, like this practice, gives us the opportunity. Without mindfulness, there is no opportunity. He's saying that there is a choice, as to why we pay attention. But if we're not mindful, if we're not conscious, we don't have a choice. We are just become the victims of our own mind, of the thoughts that our mind provides for us. So, I mean, as I reflect on my own relationship to this, as is often the case, when we put out these kind of ideas to the Dharma, they're somewhat simplistic. I mean, because we're trying to capture something that's complicated, but do it with words. And because, the one who is making the choice, if you will, is the one who is generating the thoughts. And so the choice making is not always so reliable, and this is what then creates layers of challenge for us to question. And for one, there's just habits of mind, things that we, for one reason or another, or for maybe many reasons, are drawn to certain thought patterns, certain mood states, and tend to, these are habituated. And, again, one of those things you could discuss, well, why is that? Well, cause and effect and nurturing and nature and nurture. But there we have it. And then if we are mindful, we realize, oh, this is going on. I'm not sure what to pay attention to, or I would like to not pay attention to this or whatever. And yet there's this pull, or there's an underlying emotional energy that's kind of coloring how we're thinking, how we're reacting. And so, like the if we have an aversive mind or a greedy mind or a deluded mind, we tend to go in those directions. And so my take on all of this goes back to this idea of patience, which I think I mentioned during the guided meditation. And it's something Ajahn Pasano, who was in town last week at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, was quoting something I've heard before from Ajahn Chah, the great Thai forest master, who, when asked, what do you consider the most important tool for a monk or a monastic? And he said, patience. And I think this applies to us as well, that in our practice, in this sort of choice making, when in trying to have discernment, is as much as we can to take time to kind of allow the dust to settle and see over time if we get more clarity. And part of that is, the so-called noble friends and noble conversation. So it's, we don't have to do this. We don't have to try to discern everything alone. And in fact, that's a not a particularly healthy habit. It's very kind of Western, very American. I have to do this myself. One of the reasons why sharing in meetings is so important to recovery. Hearing from other people, connecting with other people, sharing what we're believing, what we're thinking about choice-wise, and listening to wise others. So I think I'm just going to read this over again. The nature of the human mind is such that we have a whole bank of experiences, both internally within ourselves and externally from society, that impinges on us. All of that can pop up in the mind as thoughts, because that is what a mind is for, to provide thoughts. But as meditators, we have to use discernment. What are we going to invest in? What are we going to put our energy into? That is where karma is created, whether it be the mental karma of investing in thoughts of ill will, aversion, and greed, or the mental karma of investing in renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. We are making that choice. That's the karma that we're creating. So, like having these simple ideas as reflections. The Dharma, when we study it, can get overwhelming, and I can easily start talking about lists and list within lists, a little bit of a Russian dolls of Dharma teachings. Indeed, when if I'm giving a longer talk, I need more material to draw from. So sometimes I let things get more complicated. But it's another reason why I like short Dharma talks, actually. This simple idea that the job of the mind is to provide thoughts, and then my job, which assumes that I am different from my thoughts, is to discern which thoughts are useful and which thoughts are should be let go of. So I hope that's a helpful reflection for this morning, and I'll open it up for any comments or questions. I will say that, because I didn't sort of specifically refer a lot to recovery, that I hope it's evident how connected to recovery this is, since addictive thinking and the thoughts that lead to addictive behavior are ones that really need to be seen. And Megan, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. You just said something and it made me think of something and then I promptly forgot it. But I suppose sometimes when I'm meditating, I have thoughts and there might be something that I've been like ruminating on or has been in the back of my mind, and it provides a very straightforward response, and sometimes I just write that down. And then sometimes I wander off into like my habits of, planning or arranging or fixing in my mind. And I'm thinking that those habitual ways of thinking or running my mind, like I call it a train, because it's like I get on the train and I'm just going, and then I realize I'm on the train, and then I come back to the breath. But I believe that I get on the train because I'm having a feeling of some kind, and I have been able to in the past, yesterday, let's say, figure out what that feeling was. Like, what was it that caused me to get on the train? So sometimes I'm able to trace it back to that, like finding the feeling and then seeing what it is. And then if I'm feeling well, then feeling the feeling. And then, as you were talking about at the retreat, then it will sort of dissipate. But I realized that I don't know how a lot of the time I'm not exactly sure what I'm feeling. I don't know what is making me jump on the train, but it's probably fear.
Oh, that's, I appreciate what you're describing and how you're working with that. And I think maybe it's not necessary right away to put a name on what you're feeling. If you can sense it, if you can sense that there's something that's disturbing you in some way, and breathe with that. So just making it all into just the physical experience. That's, to me, that's the heart of this, that kind of practice, working with feeling. It's not about identifying what the feeling is. But I will say that just that, just feeling what we're feeling, at least for me, it took a long time to find that. And I would refer back again to the Ajahn Chah suggestion of just patience. And you don't really have to figure it out necessarily. You're engaged in a process, and that's what's important. You're seeing a lot. You're seeing the train, you're seeing the things, you're seeing that some things you're able to kind of sort out and let go, and then other things just carry you away. And so that's a big insight, just to watch that, just to see the things. And then maybe you do see, like, oh, I tend to get caught up in this type of a thinking, like this kind of worrying or planning or regretting, or that, and in some way, when we talk about, like, what are we feeling, I'm not sure there's that many different things that feelings that trigger our thinking. Like you said, there's fear, there's anger, there's grief, and variations of those. Maybe there's a couple others, but and to me, sometimes just naming something, I think does it can give a certain kind of relief, but it doesn't, just solve the problem. The feeling is still likely to be there, so I think I know what it is. Okay, yeah. It can be interesting. It can also, though, turn into another level of thinking. Oh, now, oh, why do I have so much fear? What's wrong with me? Kind of thing. And another story about me, the story of me. Yeah. It's pretty tricky, really. But I appreciate you just sharing and kind of going through your process. Yeah, it sounds like good work. Yeah. It looked like Jeff E. has got his virtual hand up. Ah, showing his
Hi.
face. Hi, Jeff.
You forgot to mention that you're teaching at the Venetia Insight Meditation
Oh yeah, thank
Group
you. Yeah, thank you.
this Sunday night.
I thought you were going to correct me about something, some Dharma topic I
No,
had.
no, 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 no. I know who the teacher in this relationship is, and it ain't me.
I'm glad because
Yeah.
sometimes not everybody knows that. But anyway, not that I have any resentments or judgments. But how are you?
I'm well. So Amaro, Ajahn
Yeah.
Amaro, a personal hero of mine,
Yeah.
he in one of his things that I've listened to, he talked about the efficacy of habit energy, how habit energy is strong and difficult to resist. Being an alcoholic and an addict, I have some familiarity with that.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, no, it got me here. It got me here, you know.
Oh,
He suggested in the same talk that you could make a habit of pausing, of reconsidering, investigating, and then reconsidering your reconsideration.
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing that he emphasized is the patience is
Yeah.
necessary for the process, as you
Yeah,
have
yeah,
emphasized today.
yeah.
And I have lately taken to the idea that there is almost never any reason for me to hurry.
Right.
You know, it's like the brakes work
Yeah.
better when you don't have to stomp on them. You know, if you just gradually break. You
Yeah.
know, and so that is currently what I do when I have what I would call less brilliant thoughts or impulses.
Yeah.
I remind myself, no hurry. It'll still be there in a minute. Why don't we think about it? It's simplistic, but it's working very well for me.
Yeah. Well, and
And as you.
patience is such a natural thing for alcoholics and addicts, we're always so patient, because we're not in a hurry to get high at all. No.
There's no reason why the bars open at 6 a.m. You know, so
Right.
but I'll see you tonight, and thanks
Oh,
as usual
good.
for your
Well, and thank you for bringing up Ajahn Amaro. I was going to mention, well, you probably know that he's been on a year-long sabbatical from April 1st of last year to March 31st of this year, and he was more or less secret. He was secretive about where he was, but now that he's out of his sabbatical, he gave a talk that is available on his podcast. So if you go on a podcast app and just look for Ajahn Amaro, which we'll put his name in the chat just for people, he talks about what he did on a self retreat for a year, And he spent half of it on the island of Corsica, which I believe is Napoleon's home, and the other half in the Cotswolds. But he t the line that the one that got me laughing was that he said he took 20 notebooks, empty notebooks to write in, and filled the most of them up, apparently. So if you know Ajahn Amro, he's verbal, to say the least, and prolific in his writing. So
Yeah,
but
he said the majority of the weight of his luggage was notebooks.
was notebooks, I know.
That's
Said
hilarious.
his sister cracked up. He said, yes, right. Yeah, we know. And I think his name is Jeffrey. Sister, like, saying, yeah, Jeffrey, good job. Anyway, and he's going to be, he'll be at Abayagiri at the end of June for their, what is it, their 40th anniversary? The 30th anniversary, 30th. Anyway, we'll keep you updated on that if anybody in the Bay Area or Northern California who wants to meet Ajahn Amro. Any other comments before we go?
Go Supersonics.
Supersonics, I see. So you're really old school there. Jeez. Wow. Okay. Quiet group this morning. It is. I mean, I usually run late, so I can leave early. Appreciate people showing up. I hope people are well and maintaining their baseline of recovery, whatever that might be. Hope to see you next Tuesday. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anybody who wants to say goodbye is welcome to do so.
Bye.
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 Go hit the golf course. Don't think basketball.
Bye.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Kevin.
All right, Steve. Thanks.
Here.
All right, folks.
Bye.